Hello, everybody. Today we have a very special guest, Tanis Hügel. Thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, you're so welcome, Iqbal. Thank you for inviting me.
We're talking about anxiety. Mm-hmm. So where does anxiety come from?
Well, in thinking about that question, Iqbal, I divided it in my own mind into two parts. There's where does anxiety come from outside us, and then it's what happens inside our nervous system that produces the emotion, the body state, the experience of being anxious. So where does anxiety come from? Well, again, I mean, it's anxiety comes from so many parts of our experience in living that I can list them. I think each person can, you know, answer a lot of that question for themselves in their individual lives. Fundamentally, anxiety comes from an experience where we do not feel safe, where something is happening to us in our environment or that triggers an internal experience where we start to believe or think that we're going to be harmed, that we're, you know, something's going to happen to us that's going to affect us, that's going to cause us pain, physical or emotional pain, something that's going to happen that impacts our feeling of safety and security. So it can be many, many, many things. It can be, you know, loud sounds. It can be a car accident. It can be the over, you know, surrounding economic and political stress. It can be things that we carry from our childhood experiences. It can be being in an abusive relationship. It can be stress at work. It can be, you know, not having a job. It can be the weather, you know, on and on and on and on and on. The sources of external anxiety that make us feel unsafe. Now, what happens internally to our nervous system when something like that happens to us? Or mm-hmm. What happens internally is very complex. So, and I'm not a neuroscientist, but I'm a somatic psychotherapist. So I'll simplify it to make it, you know, more understandable. That our brain is basically divided into three parts. There's the part that's our prefrontal cortex, the human part of our brain, the part that makes us different from other mammals, and it's our thinking and our rational brain. And then there's what's called the limbic system, and that's where basically all of our emotions are held, and that's a more primitive brain that's often referred to as the mammalian brain. And then inside that is the brainstem, and that's often called the reptilian brain. So that's the most primitive part of our brain, and in a very generally is what our body sensations and our body functions are part of our nervous system are controlled. So what happens when, you know, so we get a signal that in our experience gives us the belief that something is impacting our safety, that signal goes to what's called the amygdala, which is in the limbic system. And that then sends information right away, and that's an alarm, like, you know, the red light goes on. And then that sends information right away to the brainstem, so that arouses our sympathetic nervous system. So our muscles get tense, our heart rate speeds up, we start to, you know, look around, become very alert, very vigilant, because we're mobilizing for a defense response. We're orienting ourselves, like, what's happened? You know, we're looking around, what's going on? And we're ready to flee. To fly away, so that's the beginning of the fight and flight response, or to fight. So we're all charged up, and our breathing might get fast. And then the message will go more slowly, though, to our cerebral cortex, and we start, you know, thinking, what's going on here? I'm not safe. So that's what you're going to ask, Iqbal.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, you know, you were saying the three parts of the brain. Mm-hmm. So one is the reptilian brain, one is more the emotional brain, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, where the amygdala sits.
Amygdalae, actually, there's two of them, but that doesn't matter.
Great. Would the triggers be more in that middle part of the brain? So the where it sort of starts.
Yeah. But you know, I'm breaking it down. But in our experience, it's like faster than split second. You know, it's just like it's really fast. Our nervous system operates really, really quickly. So we're not at all aware of this.
Okay. So if I see someone going through an anxiety, how would I recognize it and how can I quickly help them?
Okay. Well, if somebody's experiencing anxiety, like, you know, sort of basic anxiety, they might be fidgety. You might see them, you know, their muscles tense. If you're looking closely enough, you might see them start to breathe more shallowly. Okay. And more quickly. You might see their eyes start to, you know, look around. You might see them maybe get flushed or more pale. And so those would be the external. They might become irritable. And they might start asking questions there because their thinking rate, their thought process is picking up, is speeding up as well.
Right. And so one would be calm with them.
Yes. Yes. One would really treat them with a lot of gentleness.
TLC.
TLC, yeah. And basically also ask them, you know, are you okay?
Right.
You know, is there anything I can do to support you? I mean, what do you need? Now that's, anxiety is different from a panic attack.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question.
Yes.
So, I mean, how do we differentiate anxiety from stress or panic attacks?
Well, panic attack is anxiety multiplied, you know, exponentially. So there's really it's very clear when somebody has a panic attack. Internally, for the person who's experiencing it, they, you know, there's a whole list of symptoms. There's like, and to be, you know, diagnosed, one only needs to have like four or five of them to be, you know, to have a full-blown panic attack. So they might have tremor, start shaking. They will feel shortness of breath.
Now, this is panic.
Panic attack. Okay. Shortness of breath. They might start to feel like they're going to choke. Their heart will start to race. They might have chest pains. They might have thoughts that they're going to die. That's a very common experience. They might fear they're going crazy. They might have heart palpitations. They will either get really like hot and sweaty, or they'll get really cold. They'll get nausea. They might throw up. They might, you know, have diarrhea. There's a whole list of things. They might have what's called derealization, which is like sort of dissociating from their body and not feeling that anything is real or they're real. They feel that they're going crazy.
How would one help these people, like when they're going through these attacks?
Well, it's similar.
Right.
To assure them that it's a panic attack, that they are not actually in danger. To help, you know, just to really support them and let them know that they're, you know, that they're not going to die. Really just to be with them because it does pass. A lot of people who know, there's not really any true understanding of what causes panic attacks. Some people know what triggers a panic attack that have them. Some people don't. Some people will go through most of their lives and not having panic attacks, and then sometimes going through menopause changes a woman's hormonal system, and then they'll start mysteriously having panic attacks. What's helpful to manage panic attacks for the individual is cognitive behavioral therapy is helpful. Knowing that it's a panic attack and telling themselves that it's a panic attack. And then taking Ativan can be helpful for getting being prescribed by their doctor just to, you know, calm with a, you know, with a chemical medication to calm.
Is
it panic attack?
What I've learned is that you don't approach someone and say, let go of the panic attack. You don't make them aware of it.
Support them in, you could let them know that they're safe.
Okay.
Let them know that they're safe, that they're not going to die, that to support them in breathing, you know, more deeply into their body, helping them ground and maybe sit down and feel secure. Just really, again, being comforting, calm in your own approach. And you know, if it's really bad, to get them help.
Right. Let's go into stress.
Mm-hmm.
What is stress, and how can we recognize it in people, mm-hmm. and how can we help people?
Mm-hmm. Well, stress is also has two meanings. Stress, I mean, one meaning of it is to put stress on something. Like, you know, if we were to really load up this table with a ton of books, the table would be stressed and might break. But it's a similar thing. So there's stress, which can be one definition of stress, or one aspect of stress is what comes from the outside that, you know, impacts us. So a lot of different, you know, events, preparing for an exam at school, for example. Well, your parents are fighting. I'm just, you know, talking about a teenager. It might be preparing for exam at school. Parents are fighting, and he also has to take care of his, you know, baby sister. So those are all sources of stress, things that are impacting in it, and his nervous system, his ability to function. So stress is often used interchangeably with anxiety in the internal experience.
Right.
But typically, you know, when we say stress, that can be interchangeable with anxiety, but often, you know, often it's like it's a little bit lower level than actual anxiety. But it can, if somebody has a lot of stress, then they'll be very, very anxious.
What has happened in our culture today? You know, as I came into the Americas now 6 years ago, I was looking for a theme in media.
Mm-hmm.
And I was made aware that stress, I mean, as I was observing the people here, they're all rushing like crazy.
Yeah.
This is multi-channeling multitasking multi-this, and kids pick up. I think women are more affected, it seems, because they're taking on double roles. They're also the earner,
right,
and the nurturer, and so could you give us a few tips about how these professional women, since I have 20,000 women listening, I might as well start trying to find ways of helping or serving them.
Of course.
What could they be doing differently?
Well, that's a really good question. So what can they be doing differently, these women, that for most of them, the circumstances in their lives can't be changed? You know, they have to work. They have to take care of the children and the house. Perhaps, depending on their relationship, they could, you know, ask for help from their spouse. I mean, that would be, a useful thing to do. It may also cause more stress. So, you know, we don't know how that can play out. For the women that are handling all of this, as I would say for, you know, anybody who's trying to manage a lot of stress, I think it's really important to take care of themselves, take care of ourselves. That is, make sure that we get, you know, proper nutrition, to make sure that we get, you know, the rest that we need to do what we can to design our days to make sure. Now, if a woman, you know, has a family, she can incorporate, you know, these patterns into her family care as well, to make sure that everybody has time for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. That everybody has, you know, in the family is, you know, gets rest and appropriate sleep at night. Practices like meditation are useful. And again, you know, this might sound like, oh my God, I have to add one more thing to my day. But if it's possible, even just for 5 minutes to take a break and just to stop, it's really, really useful. And that's something also that can be done with the children. I mean, it can be built in and made to be fun and enjoyable, something that they can do together. Doing things to find time, to make sure that they find time to do things that they enjoy, that make them feel good, is really important. And to connect with their friends, to have somebody to talk to.
again, today, when I'm teaching my Qigong, I've also created music, six-minute mm-hmm. meditations, mm-hmm. which they can listen to in the car.
Yes, yes.
And take them into certain journeys where yes. they're near the water.
Yes.
That seems to be working. But what I'm finding in the research that I'm doing, because this is, I'm trying to become an expert, or I am an expert in stress,
right.
but more with Qigong
right.
or movement.
Mm-hmm.
How to serve these people, what I've now realized when I'm talking to them, mm-hmm. These women who are professional, who are earning, who mm-hmm. are, you know, doing well
mm-hmm.
in life,
mm-hmm.
But they have this amazing burden that they're carrying. Mm. They've told me that they don't really want to confront stress, you know, because as soon as they start thinking about it and become mm-hmm. conscious of it,
mm-hmm.
they will see the burdens
mm-hmm.
and then they will start feeling not feeling well, as it were. Mm. So mm. they just override it and keep going. What would you suggest to these professional women?
Well, it's sort of like a type A personality, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just, and that's very much the orientation toward of our society also, isn't it? Just overlook it and keep going. It's straight into a heart attack, you know.
Yeah.
Because stress, anxiety affects our body. I mean, that's where it's hitting our, you know, it's not good for the body to have our, you know, breath rate be shortened and our muscles be tight and our, you know, and our thoughts to be spinning. It's terrible.
And the cortisol.
The cortisone, all of the neurotransmitters that, you know, that cause more anxiety to start, you know, are flooding through our system. We get adrenal burnout. I mean, I totally understand being, you know, having like some of those tendencies myself, that it, you know, when we have a lot of pressure, the only thing we can think of is just to get it done, right?
Right.
I can totally understand that. However, in the long run and even the short run, that's counterproductive. So the best thing is, yes, I mean, knowledge and awareness brings power fundamentally. And mindfulness, paying attention. What am I feeling in my body? Because that's the only way we can listen to what our bodies are telling us that we need. And then do what's due to take care of our bodies. These women who know how to take care of their children as mothers need to bring that same caretaking attention to themselves.
Exactly. You know, what they're saying about quality time spending with your grandparents and your children,
right.
They should spend with themselves.
Yes, yes. And people that they care about.
What about this aspect, which a lot of the teachers today are saying in the stress, is that loving yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, that's so beautiful and important. And fundamentally, you know, in the people that I work with, my clients, I mean, fundamentally, that's the core wound is our inability to love ourselves, which is also rampant in our culture, is our inability to love ourselves.
That, if we can't love ourselves, how are we loving these other people?
Well, it's a tricky thing, isn't it? I mean, we're taught, you know, that we're supposed to love others, and that it's selfish to love ourselves. I mean, it's a big obstacle that we all encounter. However, you know, it's an interactive process. The more we can really truly love ourselves, the more we can be gentle and kind with other people. When we're, you know, hard on ourselves, you know, often we're hard on other people as well. So it's to be compassionate towards ourselves is really an important practice. It's a key practice, actually.
Thank you, Tanis. Let's take a quick break and come back again. Hello, everybody. I'm Iqbal. Do you feel stressed? Do you feel tired? Are you having difficulty focusing, can't relax, brain chatter, need an audio sleep aid? Go to healingtv.ca and your audio download solutions are all there on the online store. Just click on store. Thank you. Welcome to Block Talk Radio IQ Live. Do you think that depression is one of these causes, you know, of suppressed emotions, creating stress and anxiety?
Well, you know, I can't weigh in on what exactly I think depression is, because depression is very complicated, and again, no one really knows what causes depression. So, you know, if we really knew what caused depression, we'd know how to, you know. But so to answer your question, yes, I do think a lot of what results in depression is a suppression of emotional expression, and a lot of depression is related. A lot of depression includes extreme anxiety, includes an immense amount of anxiety.
You know? Because, you know, I was reading statistics, and they're saying that 20% of the world is going to be depressed.
Doesn't surprise me.
And I was thinking, holy moly, that's a
it
huge...
It doesn't surprise me.
Okay, Tanis, would you be kind enough to take us on a visualization journey?
Certainly. Yeah, certainly. So, wherever you are right now, I invite you, unless you're driving. So if you're driving and you'd like to participate in this, if you can find a place to pull over and stop your car. If you're not driving, wherever you are, I invite you to take a position that's comfortable for your body and really just let yourself settle in to feeling comfort in your body. Just notice all the places that your body feels supported by whatever you're sitting on or lying on. And as you bring your attention to the places that your body feels supported, just notice your breath and how, as you breathe, your body just gently inflates, and you can feel perhaps the support of the sofa or the bed or the chair underneath you. And then as you exhale, just let your body sink softly more into that support. And just really let yourself take a few breaths, easy, gentle breaths. And every time you exhale, just imagine you're falling a little bit more into a mattress of down feathers, holding you very gently. And gradually start imagining that you are surrounded by your favorite color, your favorite soothing color. And just notice what that color is and really see this color surrounding your body, caressing your body gently. The hues of the color are just bathing your body like warm, soft water. And gradually, you can visualize breathing this color into your body, just noticing the sensation of breath coming either through your nostrils or mouth. And this color is entering your body, it's flowing into your lungs. And from your lungs, it's gradually seeping out into your chest, your torso. And each place this color touches, each cell this color fills, softens and releases, taking in the soothing, healing qualities of this color. And as you continue to breathe gently, just breathing in this color, see and feel this color flowing through your chest and back, soothing and softening all the muscles and the tissues as it moves through each cell, flowing down into your pelvis, lower back, into your belly. And as you breathe, just seeing that color flow down through each leg, permeating your bones, down through your ankles and in through each of your feet, filling each of your 10 toes, all the while, everywhere this color touches and fills, it offers soothing, like a gentle balm. And continuing to breathe, just feel this color now flowing through your shoulders, down each arm, gently caressing all of the tissue right down into each cell of each arm, down into each hand, filling and softening each finger. And as you continue to breathe, this color fills now, moves up through your neck and up into your head, flowing around, softening the muscles in your jaw, moving in through your inner ear, gently soothing, calming your ear, circling around the orbits of your eyes and soothing all of the small muscles that control your eyes, softening your optic nerve, moving up into your forehead, soothing your brow, moving through every part of your brain and your skull, bringing continued, infinite, calming, soothing quiet through your brain, your skull, your neck, arms and hands, your upper chest, your upper back, your belly, your pelvis, each of your legs and each of your feet. And particularly feel this color in your heart. And let yourself be savoring your whole body, resonating gently with the healing benefits of this color within you and outside of you. And I invite you now to bring your attention to the bottoms of your feet. Just press them into the floor, whatever's underneath you. Just jiggle your body a little bit. And maintaining that quality of quiet as much as you can, just bring yourself into awareness of the world right around you so that you can include the outside world with your feeling of calm and centeredness now through the rest of your day.
Thank you, Tanis. That was wonderful. Tell us more about what happened in your life that made you become a therapist, a spiritual leader, a dancer. There's so many aspects to you. What has happened in your life that brought this about?
Okay. Let's see, how can I distill down for the interest of your listeners? I think for me, I do have a history of trauma, early trauma in my life. And I masked that trauma as a teenager with eating disorder symptoms. And that allowed me to function. So I could go to university, and I was a dancer, so I trained as a dancer and got a master's in fine arts in dance and theater. And then I lived in New York City, and for many years, the center of my life, I was driven to make art. I was driven to make experimental dance theater work. And I really burned myself out. Really burned myself out. But I had the opportunity to start working with people with disability while I was in New York, and I was introduced to the healing power of art and decided that that was more interesting to me than making art to show for consumption, basically. So I went back to school and I got a degree in somatic psychology, and I then learned about drama therapy and dance therapy. I already knew about dance therapy, and I was working with a company of disabled, as a director of a company of disabled and non-disabled actors. Now I was in San Francisco. And I was just obsessed with the possibility of the joy and delight and beauty that anybody could bring into the world through their creativity, no matter what might be quote-unquote wrong with them, no matter how they might be challenged, if they had, you know, Down syndrome or cerebral palsy or brain injury or were, you know, had amputated legs or, you know, whatever it was, were paraplegic or quadriplegic even, that it was possible to, you know, to perform, to create, to have communion with other people and to experience joy and healing. So from there, I learned, because dance therapy is what healed me from my eating disorder by bringing me in touch with the trauma that I had experienced. So I had the opportunity to heal from the trauma, that symptoms were no longer necessary, because I didn't have to hide myself from it anymore. I wanted to bring dance movement therapy to people with eating disorders. So I learned to be a dance movement therapist while working at a hospital that had an eating disorders program, and actually ended up leading that program. And I became a registered board certified dance movement therapist. And I knew I wanted to work in a hospital because I knew that because eating disorders are extremely complicated illnesses, I knew I had to learn about the full range of psychiatric illnesses. So I did that, but I still continued to do my art work, my performance work, which at this point I became more interested in created sacred ritual performance than secular performance. And so that's where my art and performance focus went. And I realized too that in my experience working in the hospitals, you know, often it was a revolving door. People would be discharged and then they would come back. That fundamental to psychological illness is spiritual malaise, shall we say, feeling disconnected from spirit. And so I learned to be a spiritual director as well. And an interesting story, because at that time, in hospitals, you know, in psychiatric medicine, it was like forbidden to bring in anything spiritual, forbidden. So at one point I just decided, well, I have nothing to lose. In a group that I was leading, I decided to bring that up in the group, make that the group focus. And the patients all looked at me as if I was really, you know, out of it, because for them, they knew, for them, being in the groups and doing the therapy groups was a spiritual experience. So I had it was a big wake up for me.
Oh, beautiful. We have sort of 5 minutes mm-hmm. left over. I would like to know, can you give us some practices?
Sure. To manage anxiety.
To manage stress and anxiety.
Yeah. Well, as I said, one thing is that's really important to do is to take care of yourself and to take some time out to do things that you enjoy. I mean, I think that that's a really, really important part. And it's individual, you know. And by things I enjoy, I don't mean, unfortunately, one of the consequences of anxiety, and the elevated anxiety that we all experience in our culture is depression and anxiety disorders, but also addiction. Abusive behavior, chronic irritability, uncontrolled anger, relationship problems. It's the list is very, very, very long. So probably anxiety, I would say, is the most damaging aspect of our experience in our lives right now.
And so practices would be?
Because, as I said, anxiety is a body experience. So when you notice that your breathing is getting short, you can't focus, your thoughts are racing, your muscles are tense, you're starting to, you know, move a mile a minute. That's the cue for you to take a moment and ground yourself. So that's, to grounding yourself means just bringing your attention to your feet on the floor. If you're sitting down, taking a moment to feel your feet on the floor and your pelvis, you know, on the chair, maybe just also press your back against the chair, and that helps you feel physically more stable. It also slows things down a little
grounding.
Bit. Grounding. Grounding, yes. Mm-hmm. Taking some deeper breaths, feeling your breath move into your belly. Which happens by breathing loud, so more deeply, so the diaphragm expands and we take a deeper breath and we can feel our, as if our, you know, our bellies are swelling. Mm-hmm. So deepening the breath. Focusing on something, anything in your environment that gives you pleasure. So, you know, that's relatively still. So if it's a plant, you know, something that gives you pleasure and that just distracts you, really, from right. your anxious
thoughts. Or focuses
thoughts.
You on...
Yes, yes,
yeah,
yes.
Beautiful.
Really bringing your attention to your body and putting your thinking and your labeling of yourself as your experiences as, oh, I'm anxious, oh, you know, something's going to happen, or whatever that thought process is, to take your mind away from that, and this is mindfulness, and bringing your mind's attention to your body's experience in the grounding and the breathing. Because when we keep our attention to our mind and those thoughts, oh, you know, my boss is going to come in, or oh, I'm going to be late, or whatever that is, then that creates a vicious circle of our minds telling us that we're not safe, and then that continues the body experience that makes us more anxious. So to bring our attention away from those thoughts, right to our body, and feeling the contact of what feels stable and safe and calmer and slower around us is a big help.
Last question, two things before we end up the show. One is, can you give us your connection if people want to connect with you?
Sure.
What is your email?
Or? Okay. So I have a website. It's www.awakeningbodywisdom.com, all one word, awakening body wisdom. And my email is tanis@shaw.ca. So Tanis is like tennis with an A, TANNIS, with an extra IS on the end of it. tanis@shaw.ca for Canada.
Perfect. And the last question to you in a minute is, where are you going to now in 2013?
Oh, I think 2013 is going to be a good year for all of us. So where am I going? Well, I work part-time. I have a private practice that I see clients who are dealing with depression, trauma, addictions, eating disorders, and general life stress. And I work part-time 2 days a week at a beautiful residential treatment center called the Chopra Addiction and Wellness Center, which is north of Vancouver in the country. What I'm heading towards in my life, in the middle of March, I'm doing a workshop in authentic movement, which is a wonderful, actually, stress-reducing practice called Nurturing Presence. And here in Vancouver, it's a 2-day workshop on the 16th and 17th of March, 2 afternoon workshop. And I'm looking towards doing more community moving prayer rituals, gathering people together to do prayer together. And something that's very important that everybody needs to know about is the event on Valentine's Day called 1 Billion Rising, which is a very, very important event. It's happening all over the world, and it's 1 Billion Rising because this UN statistics prove that 1 out of every 3 women will experience sexual violence in their lives all over the world.
I thank you, Tanis, for coming on my show.
Thank you very much, Iqbal. It's a pleasure.
Have a wonderful day.
And you.